The Priest's Tale. The Man Who Cried God.
Sometimes there is a thin line separating orthodox zeal from apostasy, said Father Lennar Hoyt. So began the priest's story. Later, dictating the tale into his comm log, the consul remembered it as a seamless whole, minus the pauses, hoarse voice, false starts, and small redundancies which were the timeless failings of human speech. Lennar Hoyt had been a young priest, born, raised, and only recently ordained on the Catholic world of Pachim, when he was given his first off-world assignment. He was ordered to escort the respected Jesuit father Paul Duret into quiet exile on the colony world of Hyperion. In another time, Father Paul Duret certainly would have become a bishop and perhaps a pope. Tall, thin, ascetic, with white hair receding from a noble brow and eyes too filled with the sharp edge of experience to hide their pain. Paul Duret was a follower of St. Teilhard, as well as an archaeologist, ethnologist, and eminent Jesuit theologian. Despite the decline of the Catholic Church into what amounted to a half-forgotten cult, tolerated because of its quaintness and isolation from the mainstream of hegemony life, Jesuit logic had not lost its bite, nor had Father Duret lost his conviction that the Holy Catholic Apostolic Church continued to be humankind's last, best hope for immortality. To Lennar Hoyt as a boy, Father Duret had been a somewhat godlike figure when glimpsed during his rare visits to the pre-seminary schools, or on the would-be seminarian's even rarer visits to the New Vatican. Then, during the years of Hoyt's study in seminary, Duret had been on an important church-sponsored archaeological dig on the nearby world of Armagast. When the Jesuit returned, a few weeks after Hoyt's ordination, it had been under a cloud. No one outside the highest circles of the New Vatican knew precisely what had happened, but there were whispers of excommunication and even of a hearing before the Holy Office of the Inquisition, dormant the 4 centuries since the confusion following the death of Earth. Instead, Father Duret had asked for a posting to Hyperion, a world most people knew of only because of the bizarre Shrike cult which had originated there, and Father Hoyt had been chosen to accompany him. It would be a thankless job, traveling in a role which combined the worst aspects of apprentice, escort, and spy, without even the satisfaction of seeing a new world. Hoyt was under orders to see Father Duret down to the Hyperion spaceport, and then reboard the same spin ship for its return voyage to the world web. What the bishopric was offering Lennar Hoyt was 20 months in cryogenic fugue, a few weeks of in-system travel at either end of the voyage, and a time debt, which would return him to Pachim 8 years behind his former classmates in the quest for Vatican careers and missionary postings. Bound by obedience and schooled in discipline, Lennar Hoyt accepted without question. Their transport, the aging spinship HS Nadia Oleg, was a pockmarked metal tub with no artificial gravity of any sort when it was not under drive, no viewports for the passengers, and no onboard recreation except for the stim sims piped into the data link to keep passengers in their hammocks and fugue couches. After awakening from fugue, the passengers, mostly off-world workers, and economy-rate tourists with a few cult mystics and would-be Shrike suicides thrown in for good measure, slept in those same hammocks and fugue couches, ate recycled food in featureless mess decks, and generally tried to cope with space sickness and boredom during their 12-day, zero-G glide from their spin-out point to Hyperion. Father Hoyt learned little from Father Duret during those days of forced intimacy, nothing at all about the events on Armagast, which had sent the senior priest into exile. The younger man had keyed his comlog implant to seek out as much data as it could on Hyperion, and, by the time they were 3 days out from planetfall, Father Hoyt considered himself somewhat of an expert on the world. There are records of Catholics coming to Hyperion, but no mention of a diocese there, said Hoyt one evening as they hung talking in their zero-G hammocks, while most of their fellow passengers lay tuned into erotic stim-sims. I presume you're going down to do some mission work?
Not at all, replied Father Duray. The good people of Hyperion have done nothing to force their religious opinions on me, so I see no reason to offend them with my proselytizing. Actually, I hope to travel to the southern continent, Aquila, and then find a way inland, from the city of Port Romance. But not in the guise of a missionary. I plan to set up an ethnological research station along the cleft.
Research? Father Hoyt had echoed in surprise. He closed his eyes to key his implant. Looking again at Father Duray, he said, That section of the Pinion Plateau isn't inhabited, Father. The flame forests make it totally inaccessible most of the year. Father Duray smiled and nodded. He carried no implant, and his ancient comm log had been in his luggage for the duration of the trip.
Not quite inaccessible, he said softly. And not quite uninhabited. The Bikura live there.
Bikura? Father Hoyt said and closed his eyes. But they're just a legend, he said at last.
Said Father Duray. Try cross-indexing through Mammoth Spedling.
Father Hoyt closed his eyes again. General Index told him that Mammoth Spedling had been a minor explorer affiliated with the Shackleton Institute on Renaissance Minor, who, almost a standard century and a half earlier, had filed a short report with the Institute, in which he told of hacking his way inland from the then newly settled Port Romance, through swamplands which had since been reclaimed for fiber plastic plantations, passing through the flame forests during a period of rare quietude, and climbing high enough on the Pinion Plateau to encounter the cleft and a small tribe of humans who fit the profile of the legendary Bikura. Spedling's brief notes hypothesized that the humans were survivors of a missing seed ship colony from 3 centuries earlier, and clearly described a group suffering all of the classic retrograde cultural effects of extreme isolation, inbreeding, and overadaptation. In Spedling's blunt words, Even after less than 2 days here, it is obvious that the Bikura are too stupid, lethargic, and dull to waste time describing. As it turned out, the flame forests then began to show some signs of becoming active, and Spedling had not wasted any more time observing his discovery, but had rushed to reach the coast, losing 4 indigene bears, all of his equipment and records, and his left arm to the quiet forest in the 3 months it took him to escape. My God, Father Hoyt had said as he lay in his hammock on the Nadia Oleg. Why the Bikura?
Why not? Had been Father Duray's mild reply. Very little is known about them.
Very little is known about most of Hyperion, said the younger priest, becoming somewhat agitated. What about the Time Tombs and the legendary shrike north of the Bridal Range on Equus? He said. They're famous.
Precisely, said Father Duray. Lennar, how many learned papers have been written on the tombs and the shrike creature? Hundreds? Thousands?
The aging priest had tamped in tobacco and now lighted his pipe. No small feat in zero-G, Hoyt observed.
Besides, said Paul Duray, even if the shrike thing is real, it is not human. I am partial to human beings.
Yes, said Hoyt, ransacking his mental arsenal for potent arguments. But the Bikura are such a small mystery. At the most, you're going to find a few dozen indigenes living in a region so cloudy and smoky and unimportant that even the colony's own mapsats haven't noticed them. Why choose them when there are big mysteries to study on Hyperion, like the labyrinths? Hoyt had brightened. Did you know that Hyperion is one of the 9 labyrinthine worlds, Father?
Of course, said Duray.
A rough hemisphere of smoke expanded from him, until air currents broke it into tendrils and tributaries.
But the labyrinths have their researchers and admirers throughout the web, Lenar. And the tunnels have been there, on all 9 worlds, for how long? 500,000 standard years? Closer to 750,000, I believe. Their secret will last. But how long will the Bikura culture last before they're absorbed into modern colonial society, or more likely, or simply wiped out by circumstances?
Hoyt shrugged. Perhaps they're already gone. It's been a long time since Spedling's encounter with them, and there haven't been any other confirmed reports. If they are extinct as a group, then all of your time debt and labor and pain of getting there will be for nothing.
Precisely,
was all that Father Paul Doré had said, and puffed calmly on his pipe. It was in their last hour together, during the dropship ride down, that Father Hoyt had gained the slightest glimpse into his companion's thoughts. The limb of Hyperion had been glowing white and green and lapis above them for hours, when suddenly the old dropship had cut into the upper layers of atmosphere. Flame had briefly filled the window. And then they were flying silently, some 60 kilometers above dark cloud masses, and starlit seas, with the hurtling terminator of Hyperion sunrise rushing toward them like a spectral tidal wave of light.
Marvelous,
Paul Duret had whispered, more to himself than to his young companion.
Marvelous. It is at times like this that I have the sense, the slightest sense, of what a sacrifice it must have been for the Son of God to condescend to become the Son of Man.
Hoyt had wanted to talk then, but Father Duré had continued to stare out the window, lost in thought. 10 minutes later they had landed at Keats Interstellar. Father Duré was soon swept into the whirlpool of customs and luggage rituals, and 20 minutes after that a thoroughly disappointed Lenar Hoyt was rising toward space and the Nadia Oleg once again.
5 weeks later of my time I returned to Pachim, said Father Hoyt. I had mislaid 8 years, but for some reason my sense of loss ran deeper than that simple fact. Immediately upon my return, the bishop informed me that there had been no word from Paul Duré during the 4 years of his stay on Hyperion. The New Vatican had spent a fortune on fat-line inquiries, but neither the colonial authorities nor the consulate in Keats had been able to locate the missing priest.
Hoyt paused to sip from his water glass, and the consul said, I remember the search. I never met Duré, of course, but we did our best to trace him. Theo, my aide, spent a lot of energy over the years trying to solve the case of the missing cleric. Other than a few contradictory reports of sightings in Port Romance, there was no trace of him. And those sightings went back to the weeks right after his arrival, years before. There were hundreds of plantations out there with no radios or comm lines, primarily because they were investing bootleg drugs as well as fiberglastic. I guess we never talked to the people at the right plantation. At least I know Father Duré's file was still open when I left. Father Hoyt nodded.
I landed in Keats a month after your replacement had taken over at the consulate. The bishop had been astonished when I volunteered to return. His Holiness himself granted me an audience. I was on Hyperion less than 7 of its local months. By the time I left to return to the web, I had discovered the fate of Father Duré.
Hoyt tapped the 2 stained leather books on the table.
If I am to complete this, he said, his voice thick, I must read excerpts from these.
The tree ship Yggdrasil had turned, so the bulk of the tree had blocked the sun. The effect was to plunge the dining platform and the curved canopy of leaves beneath it into night. But instead of a few 1,000 stars dotting the sky, as would have been the case from a planet's surface, literally 1,000,000 suns blazed above, beside, and beneath the group at the table. Hyperion was a distinct sphere now, hurtling directly at them like some deadly missile.
"Read," said Martin Silenus.
From the Journal of Father Paul Duret.
Day 1. So begins my exile. I am somewhat at a loss as to how to date my new journal. By the monastic calendar on Pochim, it is the 17th day of Thomas month, in the year of our Lord 2732. By hegemony standard, it is October 12th, 589 PC. By Hyperion reckoning, or so I am told by the wizened little clerk in the old hotel where I am staying, it is the 23rd day of Lysias, the last of their 740-day months, either 426 ADC, after dropship crash, or the 128th year of the reign of sad King Billy, who has not reigned for at least 100 of those years. To hell with it. I'll call it day one of my exile. Exhausting day. Strange to be tired after months of sleep. But that is said to be a common reaction after awakening from fugue. My cells feel the fatigue of these past months of travel, even if I do not remember them. I don't remember feeling this tired from travel when I was younger. I felt bad about not getting to know young Hoyt better. He seems a decent sort, all proper catechism and bright eyes. It's no fault of youngsters like him that the church is in its final days. It's just that his brand of happy naivete can do nothing to arrest that slide into oblivion, which the church seems destined for. Well, my contributions have not helped either. Brilliant view of my new world, as the dropship brought us down. I was able to make out two of the three continents, Equus and Aquila. The third one, Ursa, was not visible. Planetfall at Keats, and hours of effort getting through customs and taking ground transit into the city. Confused images. The mountain range to the north with its shifting blue haze. Foothills forested with orange and yellow trees. Pale sky with its green-blue undercoating. The sun too small but more brilliant than Pochim's. Colors seem more vivid from a distance, dissolving and scattering as one approaches like a pointillist's palette. The great sculpture of sad King Billy, which I had heard so much about, was oddly disappointing. Seen from the highway, it looked raw and rough, a hasty sketch chiseled from the dark mountain, rather than the regal figure I had expected. It does brood over this ramshackle city of 500,000 people in a way that the neurotic poet king probably would have appreciated. The town itself seems to be separated into the sprawling maze of slums and saloons, which the locals call Jacktown and Keats itself, the so-called Old City, although it dates back only four centuries, all polished stone and studied sterility. I will take the tour soon. I had scheduled a month in Keats, but already I am eager to press on. Oh, Monsignor Edouard, if you could see me now, punished but still unrepentant, more alone than ever but strangely satisfied with my new exile. If my punishment for past excesses, brought about by my zeal, is to be banishment to the seventh circle of desolation, then Hyperion was well chosen. I could forget my self-appointed mission to the distant Bikura. Are they real? I think not this night. And content myself with living out the remainder of my years in this provincial capital on this godforsaken backwater world. My exile would be no less complete. Ah, Edouard, boys together, classmates together. Although I was not so brilliant nor so orthodox as you. Now old men together. But now you are 4 years wiser, and I am still the mischievous, unrepentant boy you remember. I pray that you are alive and well and praying for me. Tired, we'll sleep. Tomorrow, take the tour of Keats, eat well, and arrange transport to Aquila and Point South. Day 5. There is a cathedral in Keats, or rather there was one. It has been abandoned for at least 2 standard centuries. It lies in ruins, with its transept open to the green-blue skies, one of its western towers unfinished, and the other tower a skeletal framework of tumbled stone and rusted reinforcement rods. I stumbled upon it while wandering, lost, along the banks of the Hooghly River, in the sparsely populated section of town where the old city decays into Jacktown, amid a jumble of tall warehouses which prevent even a glimpse of the ruined towers of the cathedral, until one turns a corner onto a narrow cul-de-sac, and there is the shell of the cathedral. Its chapter house has half fallen away into the river. Its facade is pocked with remnants of the mournful, apocalyptic statuary of the post-Hegira expansionist period. I wandered through the latticework of shadows and fallen blocks into the nave. The bishopric on Pochum had not mentioned any history of Catholicism on Hyperion, much less the presence of a cathedral. It is almost inconceivable that the scattered seedship colony of 4 centuries ago could have supported a large enough congregation to warrant the presence of a bishop, much less a cathedral. Yet there it was. I poked through the shadows of the sacristy. Dust and powdered plaster hung in the air like incense, outlining 2 shafts of sunlight streaming down from narrow windows high above. I stepped out into a broader patch of sunlight and approached an altar stripped of all decoration except for chips and cracks caused by falling masonry. The great cross, which had hung on the east wall behind the altar, had also fallen and now lay in ceramic splinters among the heap of stones there. Without conscious thought, I stepped behind the altar, raised my arms, and began the celebration of the Eucharist. There was no sense of parody or melodrama in this act, no symbolism or hidden intention. It was merely the automatic reaction of a priest who had said Mass almost daily for more than 46 years of his life, and who now faced the prospect of never again participating in the reassuring ritual of that celebration. It was with some shock that I realized I had a congregation. The old woman was kneeling in the 4th row of pews. The black of her dress and scarf blended so perfectly with the shadows there that only the pale oval of her face was visible, lined and ancient, floating disembodied in the darkness. Startled, I stopped speaking the litany of consecration. She was looking at me, but something about her eyes, even at a distance, instantly convinced me that she was blind. For a moment I could not speak and stood there mute, squinting in the dusty light bathing the altar, trying to explain this spectral image to myself, while at the same time attempting to frame an explanation of my own presence and actions. When I did find my voice and called to her, the words echoing in the great hall, I realized that she had moved. I could hear her feet scraping on the stone floor. There was a rasping sound, and then a brief flare of light illuminated her profile far to the right of the altar. I shielded my eyes from the shafts of sunlight and began picking my way over the detritus where the altar railing had once stood. I called to her again, offered reassurances, and told her not to be afraid, even though it was I who had chills coursing up my back. I moved quickly, but when I reached the sheltered corner of the nave, she was gone. A small door led to the crumbling chapter house and the river bank. There was no sight of her. I returned to the dark interior and would have gladly attributed her appearance to my imagination,
a waking dream after so many months of enforced cryogenic dreamlessness, but for a single tangible proof of her presence. There in the cool darkness burned a lone red votive candle, its tiny flame flickering to unseen drafts and currents. I am tired of the city. I am tired of its pagan pretensions and false histories. Hyperion is a poet's world devoid of poetry. Keats itself is a mixture of tawdry, false classicism, and mindless, boomtown energy. There are 3 Zen Gnostic assemblies and 4 high Muslim mosques in the town. But the real houses of worship are the countless saloons and brothels, the huge marketplaces handling the fiber-plastic shipments from the south, and the shrike cult temples where lost souls hide their suicidal hopelessness behind a shield of shallow mysticism. The whole planet reeks of mysticism without revelation. To hell with it. Tomorrow I head south. There are skimmers and other aircraft on this absurd world, but for the common folk, travel between these accursed island continents seems restricted to boat, which takes forever, I am told, or one of the huge passenger dirigibles, which departs from Keats only once a week. I leave early tomorrow by dirigible. Day 10. Animals. The first down team for this planet must have had a fixation on animals. Horse, bear, eagle. For 3 days we were creeping down the east coast of Equus over an irregular coastline called the Main. We've spent the last day making the crossing of a short span of the Middle Sea to a large island called Cat Key. Today we are offloading passengers and freight at Felix, the major city of the island. From what I can see from the observation promenade and the mooring tower, there can't be more than 5,000 people living in that random collection of hovels and barracks. Next, the ship will make its 800-kilometer crawl down a series of smaller islands called the Nine Tails, and then take a bold leap across 700 kilometers of open sea and the equator. The next land we see, then, is the northwest coast of Aquila, the so-called Beak. Animals. To call this conveyance a passenger dirigible is an exercise in creative semantics. It is a huge lifting device, with cargo holds large enough to carry the town of Felix out to sea and still have room for thousands of bales of fiber plastic. Meanwhile, the less important cargo, we passengers, make do where we can. I have set up a cot near the aft loading portal and made a rather comfortable niche for myself with my personal luggage and 3 large trunks of expedition gear. Near me is a family of 8, indigene plantation workers returning from a biannual shopping expedition of their own to Keats. And although I do not mind the sound or scent of their caged pigs or the squeal of their food hamsters, the incessant, confused crowing of their poor, befuddled rooster is more than I can stand some nights. Animals! Day 11. Dinner tonight in the salon above the promenade deck with citizen Haramis Denzel, a retired professor from a small planters' college near Endymion. He informed me that the Hyperion first down team had no animal fetish after all. The official names of the 3 continents are not Equus, Ursa, and Aquila, but Creighton, Allenson, and Lopez. He went on to say that this was in honor of 3 middle-level bureaucrats in the old survey service. Better the animal fetish. It is after dinner. I am alone on the outside promenade to watch the sunset. The walkway here is sheltered by the forward cargo modules, so the wind is little more than a salt-tinged breeze. Above me curves the orange and green skin of the dirigible. We are between islands. The sea is a rich lapis, shot through with verdant undertones,
a reversal of sky tones. A scattering of high Cirrus catches the last light of Hyperion's too small sun and ignites like burning coral. There is no sound except for the faintest hum of the electric turbines. 300 meters below, the shadow of a huge, manta-like, undersea creature keeps pace with the dirigible. A second ago, an insect or bird the size and color of a hummingbird, but with gossamer wings a meter across, paused 5 meters out to inspect me, before diving toward the sea with folded wings. Edward, I feel very alone tonight. It would help if I knew you were alive. Still working in the garden, writing evenings in your study. I thought my travels would stir my old beliefs in St. Teilhard's concept of the God in whom the Christ of evolution, the personal and the universal, the en-o and the en-avant are joined. But no such renewal is forthcoming. It is growing dark. I am growing old. I feel something, not yet remorse, at my sin of falsifying the evidence on the Armagas dig. But, Edward, Your Excellency, if the artifacts had indicated the presence of a Christ-oriented culture there, 600 light-years from old Earth, almost 3,000 years before man left the surface of the home world, was it so dark a sin to interpret such ambiguous data in a way which could have meant the resurgence of Christianity in our lifetime? Yes, it was. But not, I think, because of the sin of tampering with the data, but the deeper sin of thinking that Christianity could be saved. The Church is dying, Edward. And not merely our beloved branch of the Holy Tree, but all of its offshoots, vestiges, and cankers. The entire body of Christ is dying, as surely as this poorly used body of mine, Edward. You and I knew this in Armagast, where the blood sun illuminated only dust and death. We knew it that cool, green summer, at the college when we took our first vows. We knew it as boys, in the quiet playfields of Villefranche-sur-Saône. We know it now. The light is gone now. I must write by the slight glow from the salon windows a deck above. The stars lie in strange constellations. The middle sea glows at night with a greenish, unhealthy phosphorescence. There is a dark mass on the horizon to the southeast. It may be a storm, or it may be the next island in the chain, the third of the 9 tails. What mythology deals with a cat with 9 tails? I know of none. For the sake of the bird I saw earlier, if it was a bird, I pray that it is an island ahead, and not a storm. Day 28. I have been in Port Romance 8 days, and I have seen 3 dead men. The first was a beached corpse, a bloated white parody of a man, that had washed up on the mudflats beyond the mooring tower my first evening in town. Children threw stones at it. The second man I watched being pulled from the burned wreckage of a methane unit shop in the poor section of town near my hotel. His body was charred beyond recognition and shrunken by the heat, his arms and legs pulled tight in the prize-fighter posture burning victims have been reduced to since time immemorial. I have been fasting all day, and I confess with shame that I began to salivate when the air filled with the rich, frying fat odor of burned flesh. The third man was murdered not 3 meters from me. I had just emerged from the hotel onto the maze of mud-splattered planks that serve as sidewalks in this miserable town, when shots rang out, and a man several paces ahead of me lurched, as if his foot had slipped, spun toward me with a quizzical look on his face, and fell sideways into the mud and sewage. He had been shot 3 times with some sort of projectile weapon. 2 of the bullets had struck his chest, the 3rd entered just below the left eye. Incredibly, he was still breathing when I reached him. Without thinking about it, I removed my stole from my carrying bag, fumbled for the vial of holy water I had carried for so long, and proceeded to perform the sacrament of extreme unction. No one in the gathering crowd objected. The fallen man stirred once, cleared his throat as if he were about to speak, and died. The crowd dispersed even before the body was removed. The man was middle-aged, sandy-haired, and slightly overweight. He carried no identification, not even a universal card or comm log. There were 6 silver coins in his pocket. For some reason, I elected to stay with the body the rest of that day. The doctor was a short and cynical man, who allowed me to stay during the required autopsy. I suspect that he was starved for conversation. "This is what the whole thing's worth," he said, as he opened the poor man's belly like a pink satchel, pulling the folds of skin and muscle back and pinning them down like tent flaps. "What thing?" I asked. "His life," said the doctor, and pulled the skin of the corpse's face up and back like a greasy mask. "Your life, my life." The red and white stripes of overlapping muscle turned to blue bruise around the ragged hole just above the cheekbone. "There has to be more than this," I said. The doctor looked up from his grim work with a bemused smile. "Is there?" he said. "Please show me." He lifted the man's heart and seemed to weigh it in one hand. "In the web worlds, this would be worth some money on the open market. There are those too poor to keep vat-grown, cloned parts on store, but too well off to die just for want of a heart. But out here it's just awful." "There has to be more," I said, although I felt little conviction. I remembered the funeral of His Holiness Pope Urban XV shortly before I left Pachim. As has been the custom since pre-Hegira days, the corpse was not embalmed. It waited in the anteroom off the main basilica to be fitted for the plain wooden coffin. As I helped Edouard and Monsignor Frey place the vestments on the stiffened corpse, I noticed the browning skin and slackening mouth. The doctor shrugged and finished the perfunctory autopsy. There was the briefest of formal inquiries. No suspect was found, no motive put forward. A description of the murdered man was sent to Keats, but the man himself was buried the next day in a pauper's field between the mud flats and the yellow jungle. Port Romance is a jumble of yellow, weirwood structures, set on a maze of scaffolds and planks, stretching far out onto the tidal mudflats at the mouth of the Cants. The river is almost 2 kilometers wide here, where it spills out into Toschehe Bay. But only a few channels are navigable, and the dredging goes on day and night. I lie awake each night in my cheap room with the window open, to the pounding of the dredge hammer sounding like the booming of this vile city's heart, the distant susurration of the surf, its wet breathing. Tonight I listen to the city breathe, and cannot help but give it the flayed face of the murdered man. The companies keep a skimmer port on the edge of town to ferry men and materiel inland to the larger plantations. But I do not have enough money to bribe my way aboard. Rather, I could get myself aboard, but cannot afford to transport my 3 trunks of medical and scientific gear. I am still tempted. My service among the Bikura seems more absurd and irrational now than ever before. Only my strained need for a destination and a certain masochistic determination to complete the terms of my self-imposed exile keep me moving upriver. There is a riverboat departing up the Khans in 2 days. I have booked passage and will move my trunks onto it tomorrow. It will not be hard to leave Port Romance behind. Day 41. The emperotic Girandole continues its slow progress upriver. No sight of human habitation since we left Melton's Landing 2 days ago. The jungle presses down to the riverbank, like a solid wall now. More, it almost completely overhangs us in places, where the river narrows to 30 or 40 meters. The light itself is yellow, rich as liquid butter. Filtered as it is through foliage and fronds 80 meters above the brown surface of the Khans. I sit on the rusted tin roof of the center passenger barge and strain to make out my first glimpse of a Tesla tree. Old Katie, sitting nearby, pauses in his whittling, spits over the side through a gap in his teeth and laughs at me. "Ain't gonna be no flame trees this far down," he says. "If they was, the forest sure as hell wouldn't look like this. You gotta get up in the pinions before you see a Tesla. We ain't out of the rainforest yet, Padre." It rains every afternoon. Actually, rain is too gentle a term for the deluge that strikes us each day, obscuring the shore, pounding the tin roofs of the barges with a deafening roar, and slowing our upstream crawl until it seems we are standing still. It is as if the river becomes a vertical torrent each afternoon, a waterfall which the ship must climb if we are to go on. The Girandole is an ancient, flat-bottomed tow with 5 barges lashed around it like ragged children clinging to their tired mother's skirts. 3 of the 2-level barges carry bales of goods to be traded or sold at the few plantations and settlements along the river. The other 2 offer a simulacrum of lodging for the indigenes traveling upriver, although I suspect that some of the barges' residents are permanent. My own berth boasts a stained mattress on the floor and lizard-like insects on the walls. After the rains, everyone gathers on the decks to watch the evening mists rise from the cooling river. The air is very hot and super-saturated with moisture most of the day now. Old Katie tells me that I have come too late to make the climb through the rain and flame forests before the Tesla trees become active. We shall see. Tonight, the mists rise like the spirits of all the dead who sleep beneath the river's dark surface. The last tattered remnants of the afternoon's cloud cover dissipate through the treetops, and color returns to the world. I watch as the dense forest shifts from chrome yellow to a translucent saffron, and then slowly fades through ochre to umber to gloom. Aboard the Girandole, old Katie lights the lanterns and candle globes hanging from the sagging second tier, and, as if not to be outdone, the darkened jungle begins to glow with the faint phosphorescence of decay, while glowbirds and multi-hued gossamers can be seen floating from branch to branch in the darker upper regions. Hyperion's small moon is not visible tonight, but this world moves through more debris than is common for a planet so close to its sun, and the night skies are illuminated by frequent meteor showers. Tonight the heavens are especially fertile, and when we move on to wide sections of the river, we can see a tracery of brilliant meteor trails weaving the stars together. Their images burn the retina after a while, and I look down at the river only to see the same optic echo there in the dark waters. There is a bright glow on the eastern horizon, and old Katie tells me that this is from the orbital mirrors, which give light to a few of the larger plantations. It is too warm to return to my cabin. I spread my thin mat on the rooftop of my barge and watch the celestial light show, while clusters of indigenous families sing haunting songs in an argot I have not even tried to learn. I wonder about the Bikura, still far away from here, and a strange anxiety rises in me. Somewhere in the forest an animal screams with the voice of a frightened woman. Day 60. Arrived Paracebo Plantation. Sick. Day 62. Very ill. Fever. Fits of shaking. All yesterday I was vomiting black bile. The rain is deafening. At night the clouds are lit from above by orbital mirrors. The sky seems to be on fire. My fever is very high. A woman takes care of me, bathes me. Too sick to be ashamed. Her hair is darker than most indigenes. She says little. Dark, gentle eyes. Oh, God, to be sick so far from home. Day. She is waiting, spying. Comes in from the rain, the thin shirt. On purpose to tempt me. Knows what I am, my skin burning on fire, thin cotton nipples. Dark against it, I know who they are watching. Hear their voices at night, they bathe me in poison, burns me, they think I don't know, but I hear their voices above the rain when the screaming stops. Stop, stop. My skin is almost gone. Red underneath, can feel the hole in my cheek. When I find the bullet, I will spit it out. Agnus Dei quitoli specta tamundi miserere nobis, miserere. Day 65. Thank you, dear Lord, for deliverance from illness. Day 66. Shaved today. Was able to make it to the shower. Sempha helped me prepare for the administrator's visit. I expected him to be one of the large, gruff types I've seen out the window, working in the sorting compound. But he was a quiet black man with a slight lisp. He was most helpful. I had been concerned about paying for my medical care, but he reassured me that there would be no charge. Even better, he will assign a man to lead me into the high country. He says it is late in the season, but if I can travel, in 10 days we should be able to make it through the flame forest to the cleft before the Tesla trees are fully active. After he left, I sat and talked to Sempha a bit. Her husband died here 3 local months ago in a harvesting accident. Sempha herself had come from Port Romance. Her marriage to Michael had been a salvation for her, and she has chosen to stay on here doing odd jobs rather than go back downriver. I do not blame her. After a massage, I will sleep. Many dreams about my mother recently. 10 days. I will be ready in 10 days. Day 75. Before leaving with Tuck, I went down to the Matrix Paddies to say goodbye to Sempha. She said little, but I could see in her eyes that she was sad to see me go. Without premeditation, I blessed her and then kissed her on the forehead. Tuck stood nearby, smiling and bobbing. Then we were off, leading the 2 packbrids. Supervisor Orlandi came to the end of the road and waved as we entered the narrow lane hacked into the aureate foliage. Domine, dirige nos. Day 82. After a week on the trail. What trail? After a week in the trackless yellow rainforest. After a week of exhausting climb up the ever-steeper shoulder of the Pinyon Plateau, we emerged this morning onto a rocky outcropping that allowed us a view back across an expanse of jungle toward the beak in the Middle Sea. The plateau here is almost 3,000 meters above sea level, and the view was impressive. Heavy rain clouds spread out below us to the foot of the Pinyon Hills, but through gaps in the white and gray carpet of cloud we caught glimpses of the Khans, in its leisurely uncoiling toward Port R, and the sea, chrome-yellow swatches of the forest we had struggled through, and a hint of magenta far to the east. The Tuck swore was the lower matrix of fiber-plastic fields near Paracebo. We continued onward and upward late into the evening. Tuck is obviously worried that we will be caught in the flame forests when the Tesla trees become active. I struggled to keep up, tugging at the heavily laden brid and saying silent prayers to keep my mind off my aches, pains, and general misgivings.